To be sustainable is not to go very far, it's to use objects that are around you, not very expensive. You don't make them, you take what you can put your hands on and you transform it into something else.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is the artist Joanna Vasconcelos. Welcome, Joanna.
Hello.
Joanna, I'm interested in how the guests who I speak to got into art. So what was your first touch point with art and the possibility of making art and becoming an artist?
That's a difficult question because I come from an artistic family. And so everybody around me was doing things with their hands. And so since I'm very little, I was building these little sculptures or doing knitting, or I was always doing something, and my mother was doing something, and my grandmother, and everyone around me was always, you know, all, both my grandmothers were knitting or cooking or doing things. So I cannot say, like, you know, like singers, they talk about their first concert or when you go to public or your first show. But actually, I always remember myself of doing things with my hands. So when I was 17, I got my first studio. My parents found me a studio because I was already burning the bedroom. So it was a little bit dangerous.
Why burning? You worked with fire?
Because I was just making collages and I had a little torch, camping gas torch.
Yeah.
And I was like trying things and they looked at me and said, yeah, we better find her a studio. So I had my first studio when I was 17 and I was still at school, art school, and I was already doing shows back then. When I was 23, 24, I was already exhibiting with my colleagues from school in, you know, empty houses, strange places. So actually, what I can remember from myself is always being an artist.
Really. Okay. Because first you started to work as a jewelry designer, right?
Yes, I did. I studied three things. I studied karate for many years. Uh-huh. 30 years I did karate. Then I did drawing lessons and then I did jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied jewelry for 7 years too and drawing like that.
Everything in Portugal, right?
Yes, everything in a private school. Yeah.
And then, so you were doing first applied art and then all parallel?
No. First, I went to a high school, arts high school, and then I wanted to go to architecture.
Okay.
Because my father had studied architecture.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to go to architecture. I couldn't get in. Then I didn't have enough grades to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So then I tried to go to Beaux-Arts to make painting or sculpture, which I didn't got in either.
In Paris?
And no, in Portugal.
Okay.
And then I applied to design courses. So for a year, I was in a design school. And I was a very bad student.
Mm-hmm.
And so then my father said, okay, this is not working. So you should do something with your hands because that's what I was always doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. I started going to jewelry. And I went also to drawing, which I already was doing.
Yeah.
And so then I combined them both for 3 or 4 years. And then I applied to a contemporary art degree in this school. And I got it. I got in. And then I did 2 more years in contemporary art, which were projects and more exhibitions and preparation for shows. And so it was very good.
Interesting. And I mean, you did massive shows in Versailles, in, like, when you do an exhibition, it's like a blockbuster audience success with tens of thousands of people coming to see your show. How did sort of the step out of Portugal worked? How did you manage that?
Well, it started quite normal. First, you know, it depends in your geography. So I was talking like Erwin Wurman is from here, and we were seeing that in a way. We all expand by the countries around us. So I started by exhibiting in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
First country I got out of Portugal was Spain, which is naturally
neighborhood.
And they chose me to a group show in Valencia in Adelantado Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really nice for me. I was like, I'm getting out of Portugal. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was invited also to do a show next year in Brazil, mm-hmm. which is the biggest
same, you know, language, yeah,
same language, and people know us. So that was quite natural. And from there, I started doing things a little bit throughout the world. And so I was exhibiting in Spain and in Brazil, then in France, then in Austria, then here and there, whatever my work took me.
So it just grew naturally. And when did you sort of dare to do these mega size projects?
Well, I wanted to do them since the beginning, but I didn't have the means or the money. And people would not believe that, you know, a female artist would do large projects. So my first attempt, and which I succeeded, was in Sahalfish in 1996, where I did a huge installation in the gardens, outdoors. And that was pretty cool because it was my first time a museum invited me. And they paid for the production. That was pretty cool, too. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the transports and everything. But I miscalculated one of the structures, and it came down 2 days before the opening. And then they helped me to put it back up. And it was pretty cool because I understood that I had to have more skills than I actually had at that period.
Yeah.
So I couldn't calculate all the engineering issues and landscapes. And so I built my studio to be able to respond to all the invitations and to all the shows that I was getting into. So my studio was small, and then I started building it larger so I would have engineers and architects to help me out to build these large sculptures.
Interesting. So, I mean, the Seraivis invitation was a really big step. You were quite young also at that point, no? And then you noticed that you sort of also not to be dependent on others, you need to build an infrastructure which allows you to realize this.
Yes, because coming from Portugal, there is no big galleries like yours. So in a way, most artists that I encounter through the years, they rely on the gallery a lot. And galleries are a huge support for the careers of artists. But coming from a place where there isn't, you have to think, okay, nobody's going to help me anyway. So either I do it or I don't. So it's really, you cannot rely on the gallery or on the collector
or the museum.
Or the museum, yeah, because they don't exist. No, now there is more. But when I started 30 years ago, it was a completely different reality.
Yeah, but also they don't have a production infrastructure, so to speak.
Exactly.
But also, I guess, control is very important for you.
I like to go every step of the way and to verify that the project that I'm getting into will end up exactly as I saw it. So yeah, I really like to see if every part, engineering, architecture, drawing, textures, everything will get to where I'm aiming for.
Because you have a big studio with, I think, 60 people or something like this.
Yeah.
It's more like an architect department. Everything is produced in the studio. How do you, before we dive more deep into your artistic practice, how do you combine sort of artistic creative process with the management skills you need to run such a corporation?
Well, I don't know. What I did was, it's very organic. So it started by me and one assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I did jewelry courses, and then I started as a jewel maker. And then very fast, my friends in fashion or opera, they would invite me to do larger things and scenarios and, you know, crowns. And so I became to do very fast and very young, big things. And so I was invited to do that, and I didn't have any help. So I had my first assistant coming from the jewelry department. She studied, like me, jewelry. And then from there, I said, perhaps we should have some more help. So we start using a scenario team that would work for a cinema, for films. And so they would help me out to build my pieces, and they were doing, you know, films, and at the same time, they would help me out. Okay. So I share a space with them. And then I said, okay, I need to grow and have more teams. So I have the architectural, engineering, crochet, financials. So I had to build a whole structure to be able to deal with all the other structures that were inviting me. So if a museum comes and invites me, I had to respond to all the departments of the museum. So
yeah,
I built my own departments the same way. So I had somebody that would interconnect with the museum. So that was my starting point. And then in a way, when I start going further and further, I understood the needs that I would have to be able to build something that was secure, that was reliable, and at the same time, that would be exactly what I had in my mind. Mm-hmm. So every step of the way, I need to see what the teams are working and how they're working so I can be part of the process. I like to be part of the process. I really don't like to do outsourcing and mm-hmm. not seeing what's going on. So I'm a kind of a control freak because I like to see and say, oh, no, I don't like this.
And interfere in the process.
Yes.
But I think it's interesting because the artist per se, I think, is quite entrepreneurial, right? You have to be innovative. You have to take risks, you know. So you just mentioned crochet. That's a very signature element of your practice. So there are these famous references to this Portuguese sculptor who did the animals, which you covered in crochet, but you also do these paintings or mirrors where crochet sort of grows out of them, or this huge immersive installation. How did you come to the crochet? How did it come to your work?
So I learned crochet with my grandmother, one of them. And then I like to recycle a lot, and I like to be sustainable. So I think that you don't need to look much further from your home to mm-hmm. create mm-hmm. things. So I was just, you know, one day I was thinking I had to go to Brazil, as I told the beginning. So I was invited to do a show in Triangle Gallery mm-hmm. and then the Biennale. And I was invited also to bring something with me. And I was like, what can I bring that won't occupy much space? So I had these knitting things that I was doing with my assistant, Clara. And I said, oh, if we would put together this in a in a suitcase, we could go to Brazil without having to spend money in transport. So we went to Brazil only with a T-shirt, mm-hmm. some pants and some slippers. And we bought the biggest, you know, suitcases that we could ever buy in Portugal. Mm-hmm. And we put all the pieces inside. We didn't take any clothes.
But you put the crochet inside.
Because the crochet is like fabric, so it's like clothes. So we knitted everything. We put it on the suitcase and we went to Brazil to this Metropolis program. And in the gallery, everybody was, oh, what is this? So it started a little bit like, you know.
And then you took the crochet and wrapped it.
I would fill them in Brazil. So they would go empty.
Ah, okay.
And I arrive in Brazil and put, you know, the thing that you put inside of pillows.
Yeah, yeah, to create volume.
So they would go like, you know, any clothes, and I'll bend them, fold them, put it on the suitcase. And I would arrive in Brazil and fill them up there.
And then there was
very sculptural
sculptures in the like volume in the space, or also on the wall back then.
In the space and on the wall.
Already then.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So it came from this sort of how can
I travel
practical approach.
Yeah.
And then the crochet, because I think, you know, like Yves Klein owns the blue, Nietzsche owns the blood, you own the crochet. You know.
I'm the owner of crochet. You know, crochet is for everybody. It's something that it's done everywhere.
Yeah, but it wasn't in the art before, no?
No. Rosemary Trockel did a lot of crochet, and Louise Bourgeois did a lot of crochet. What I did...
True, but more minimal, right? Not in this pattern, yeah.
Now, what I did was I brought a monumental aspect to textiles.
Yeah.
And I believe that textiles are a good material as any other.
Yeah.
And I brought monumentality to it. And if you think about Annette Messager, she also knits. So there's a lot of knitting in the women's art world. But to bring it to a level of monumentality, I think I was the first to believe that they could be big, the pieces. They could occupy the space and create a dialogue with the architectural spaces.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the difference.
And another remarkable sculpture you created are these, it's like an ice cream cone built of, how's it called? Sand molds for children in the sandbox.
Yeah.
Where also, I mean, it's almost as crochet as well somehow. You take one element and multiply it and create sort of a pattern. So it's like a logic in your work that you take elements and sort of blow them up or enlarge them?
Yeah, like in the pop world or the voyeurism, I take out the objects of the everyday life objects. I don't do anything to them. The only thing I do is I decontextualize them. So I take them from their natural environment. I put them in another object, and then they become something else. So they are decontextualized and recontextualized in another dimension. So suddenly a pot from the shoe, for instance, or the sand walls, they become an ice cream, or the pots and pans become a shoe, or, you know, it's a kind of a transformation attitude towards everyday objects.
And you like the idea that because you bring it together, it becomes an artwork. You like the idea that it also could be like sort of deaccession or taken off the artwork and become a normal object again?
In a way, when I take the pot, the rice pot, and it becomes a shoe, both of them are from the domestic environment. They belong to the same world, which is the house.
Yeah.
Okay, but a shoe made with pots, it's really strange because it's in this surrealistic moment that I have a lot of fun. It's like, okay, suddenly, a sand mold becomes an ice cream and it doesn't make any sense. But it does in a conceptual way.
Yeah.
So I bring the conceptual aspect into the equation by transforming objects to something else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And another monumental piece you created is like a pavilion or like a temple, which is a huge cake with a lot of
tiles
and ceramic or porcelain sculptures on the facade. Maybe you can explore a little bit on this.
Well, I wanted to do three things that were always on my mind, which are the stereotypes of marriage. So for many women, the wedding day is the transforming moment of their lives. When they come out of from one family and they go into another family or into their own family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an Independence Day kind of freedom thing. And sometimes it's not. So it depends how you look into it. But the truth is, the wedding day is a very important moment for most women. And I think the most important moment many times.
Mm-hmm.
So there's three symbols. There's the wedding ring, there's the wedding dress, and the wedding cake.
And with a wedding ring, you mean the engagement ring?
Engagement ring.
Yeah.
So I did the three.
Yeah.
So I did the in Venice Biennale in 2005.
Where you did the Portuguese pavilion?
No, I did the wedding dress with mm-hmm. the tampons, the chandelier with tampons, with 14,000 tampons. It's called the bride.
Mm-hmm.
Then I did the wedding ring with the whiskey glasses and the rim wheels.
Which is in front of the museum in Lisbon.
In Lisbon, mm-hmm. in Mott. And then I did the wedding cake in Watson Manor in the Rothschild Foundation.
And you had that already in mind?
Yeah.
You always had the plan to do these three elements, yeah?
Yeah?
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So it's a part of the symbols of the wedding.
Yeah.
And so when I met...
Maybe the bouquet is missing, you know, which is thrown...
Yeah, the bouquet, it's also part of it, but I've done a few bouquets already. But, you know, it's to do a large temple thing like I did for the wedding cake with the tiles, it was to bring out, you know, this traditional thing of weddings, of temples, and of belvederes, of trianons. There's an historical history of these small architectural buildings that are not for any use specifically,
mm-hmm.
and the pastry. So there's a moment where pastry encounters architecture, and pastry is influenced by architecture, and architecture is influenced by pastry.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to admit that that moment exists, but mm-hmm, it does. Mm-hmm. So what I did was this encounter between pastry and architecture into a temple, which doesn't make any sense, but I did it anyway. So it's a four-floor building. It's completely done with a metallic structure covered in ceramics, and not only with tiles, with decorative pieces and a lot of elements coming out of the walls. And so actually you can go inside. There's a dome inside. And then also you can go up. And when you go up to the fourth level, it's very narrow. Only two people can fit on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And you might encounter somebody that you know, somebody that you don't know. Two women can be there or two men can be there. So you become the two figures on the top.
Okay, like the
like, mm-hmm. like the little sculptures they put on the wedding cake.
Yeah, yeah. But I think this immersive experiential part is very important in your work in general, but also in this experience, I guess, no?
Yes, because in a way I'm a performer too. So I love people to perform with my artworks. And I love that people are part of the project and part of the performance themselves. So when people visit my artworks, they feel engaged with the artwork and they experience the artwork. And people now use immersive. I said, okay, it's immersive too, but it's more the, it's more like asking people to look at it and think about it and be part of it, is to share what mm-hmm. you do with others.
So you have a, you have an issue with the term immersive?
No, I don't. I love it, but I've been doing immersive experience for many years.
Oh, yeah, before this whole immersive thing.
Everybody's like immersive here, immersive there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, like, okay, cool, but in a way, I've been sharing my work.
But it's interesting what you say, because I think this immersive trend from institution is that they understood they need to involve the visitor more, you know, because it's a bit like in schooling or also in the church, you know, in the Second Vatican Concil, they changed the altar, no, not the altar, but the where the preacher man is, like in the school too, you know, you have this frontier teaching, like you have a blackboard on one side of the school, and then they changed to that the altar needs to be in the middle inside the community. And it's a bit, I guess, also with the painting on the wall and the spectator in front, while in your installations, this the spectator becomes sort of part of the work, no?
I think that what you're describing is something that is really happening today due to the history and how and about all the problems we have around us, which is we need to reconnect with each other and we need to reconnect with our spirituality, with our body, with our minds. So when you invite people to be part of the process, you're connecting with people, you're getting closer to them. So when the altar moves in the church, you're asking people to be more involved, to be around it. And so all the experiences, I think that in our days, we are much more able to connect with the artworks and to be part of it than we were before. There was a huge distance for paintings. You could not touch. You could not get close to it. You should not touch the artworks. All that distance was like putting you in a position where you were not able to dialogue with the artworks. The artworks was a level of understanding, and you as public were in another level of understanding, of consciousness.
Yeah.
And today, I think that that gap has been shortened, and now we think that we can connect with each other more easily, and there is not such a distance between the creator, the artwork, and the public. The public is much more evolved. They know a lot more, so now they're much more able to criticize, to talk about the artwork. There, the distance has is not, as it was before, a very large one. Mm-hmm. And so today, I think artists need to feel more connected with the public and vice versa. And the public needs to interact with the artworks because they know better. And so in a way, the immersive thing that Yayoi Kusama did so many, many years ago is much more acceptable today than it was before.
Yeah. When I visited your exhibition in Lisbon, I was impressed by a car you did, which I find quite interesting because like art works of cars is a very male-dominated theme, I would say. And but you take it, and maybe you can explore. And you did a very sort of like a girl's dream car, or like a princess dreams car.
So every one of us has a male side and a female side. Sometimes I work with my male side, and sometimes I work with my female side. But to say that I like the encounter of both. And the balance between female side and male side, it's a difficult one. So sometimes I try better and I'm more succeeded in one side than the other. But the car is obviously a male symbol that I wanted to add a more female aspect to it. So I took a Porsche and I transformed the Porsche into a Baroque, like a Baroque carriage. And I took a lot of things from the Baroque style, the Portuguese Baroque style, and in wood, and I carved in wood, and I put gold leaf. So the whole Porsche is decorated with Baroque woodwork. And then on the backside of the Porsche, I have these ostrich feathers, really red, like a very sensual woman. So in front, I have a very traditional woman, and on the back of the car, I have a more sensual woman. So
almost like a Cinderella Porsche.
It's a Cinderella Porsche.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and again, it's combining this female aspect with the male aspect of speed, strength, and cars and power.
Yeah. And right now we present here like a surreal bathroom. I think the starting point, I guess, was a urinal in reference to Marcel Duchamp. Or
yes,
I think there's a debate if it was really Marcel Duchamp. So how did this come about? Why this these elements?
Well, Marcel Duchamp was a very male artist, and I decided to do a gay version of the urinal. Mm-hmm. And so I put mm-hmm. together two urinals, decorated with a crochet, and it's a very gay piece. And at the same time, I started talking about sustainability and about water and how water affects the planet and how we do not take care of water. And so water, for me, is one of the most incredible luxuries that the planet gives to you. And so I was like really thinking about how I could add something and to bring alive this consciousness that you cannot spend water in a strange way as we do. And so I started doing these shower heads, things that were connected with the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the bathroom, well, I've done things with the kitchen, I've done things with bathrooms and living room. So for me, as I was saying at the beginning, to be sustainable is not to go very far, is to use objects that are around you, not very expensive. You don't make them. You take what you can put your hands on and you transform it into something else. So I'm a low-tech artist. And I take things that...
Like a collagist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so mm-hmm. When I went to the bathroom, I said, oh my God, there's so many things I can do with the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I start using objects of the bathroom, you know, the things, the bathtub or the urinals or the mirrors. Or I've been using head showers and a lot of things from bathroom.
It's interesting that you on the one side have this control or this like headquarter where you keep control, but then you assemble... objet trouvé, found objects almost, which you sort of collage together, but on site, right?
Yes. So it's true because I think we are a result of what came before us. So
yeah.
If there wasn't the objet trouvé, pop art, nouveau réalisme, surrealism, baroque periods, I wouldn't be here. So I have a little bit of many things that influence my and make me who I am. So I'm very proud to be here and looking back to the history, I'm like, oh my God, there were so amazing artists doing so many great things that in a way I can add something to everything that was already done. That's a privilege, and I feel influenced by lots of artists in many ways. But the thing is looking around you and saying, oh, what can I do from my own spot, my own house, from my own studio without spending much money or asking, to pick this or that. So in a way, when you're reduced to your own mind and your own surroundings, are you able to expand? That's the big question.
Mm-hmm.
So when I take everyday objects or found objects, I'm like, okay, what can I do with this that I can bring something new to the equation?
And talking about Portugal and these sculptures you do of the Portuguese sculptor, how did that come apart? Because I think also the tradition or the roots of your origin is important in your practice too, no? You try to homage to it?
Yeah, because of course I'm Portuguese. So what surrounds me is the Portuguese
culture.
Okay, so
you just naturally picked it up.
Exactly,
yeah.
Because that's, again, coming back to sustainability, you don't spend much because you should eat and be embedded of what surrounds you.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what surrounds me is the Portuguese culture. I was born in Portugal. I was not born in Portugal. I was born in France, but I always lived in Portugal, so I'm surrounded by that culture.
Yeah.
And being an amazing culture, like all cultures, by the way.
Yeah.
I have so many traditions that I can look up and say, oh my God, look at that. That's amazing. How can I transform that? Oh, look at that. So in a way, I'm ambassador for my country because it's on that country that I live and I work.
And when you represented your country at the Venice Biennale, you created a sort of floating pavilion. You built a boat. Maybe you can tell us about this.
You know, the Portuguese went through sea to many countries and they trade with many countries. And that happened in the 15th century.
And colonized too, no?
And colonized too.
Yeah.
But the trading through Europe was coming to Venice. Through Venice.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And since the Portuguese discovered the maritime routes, the traffic through Venice stopped. So Venice is in the 15th century due to the Portuguese discoveries. So in a way, we are responsible for the fact that Venice stayed in the 15th century forever and ever. And at that year, the Biennale was about, you know, connecting within countries. And I said, okay, how we Portuguese connect with, or how Lisbon connects with Venice. And it was due to the fact of navigation and boats. So I said, I'm going to take a boat, the Portuguese boat of today, to Venice of today. And what is the Venice of today? Is the Vaporetos. So I said, okay, I'm going to take the Portuguese Vaporetto into Venice. Mm-hmm. That was my first approach.
And it was moving around?
It was moving around.
And what was to see on the boat?
On the boat inside, I transformed boat. Our Vaporetto, which is a ferry, they're much bigger than the ones in Venice. So it's a boat that can have 300 people. So it's a 60 meters long boat. So it's quite big. And it's a boat that came from Hamburg and to Portugal. And in Portugal it was dismantled here in Hamburg. And then it went to Portugal and rebuilt in another way. So these boats ran for more than 50 years in Portugal. Then they stopped them and they were about to sell them to Angola. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, I'll take one. Mm-hmm. So I recovered one. And inside of the boat where people would be sitting, I transformed it into a Moby Dick kind of inside of the whale world. Mm-hmm. So you would get inside and you would dive into this magical knitting world with lights. And outdoors, I would have the city of Lisbon painted in tiles. Mm-hmm. But the city of Lisbon was today, not the city of Lisbon of the 15th
century. Yeah, okay. So build the grid bridge between historical...
Because the most important tile... object we have is the city of Lisbon before the earthquake. Mm-hmm. And it's painted. It's a panel that has 21 meters and describes Lisbon back then.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to make a parallel in time also with Venice. What was Venice and what is Venice today? What was Lisbon? What is Lisbon today? Mm-hmm. And in a way, the relationship between Lisbon and Venice is through water and boats.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But that's actually worth mentioning also that you do large tile facade commissions. I saw a beautiful one in Porto.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
After that, I started doing that because first I did the boat.
Coming from Venice, yeah?
Yeah, interesting. From the boat, everybody was like, oh, you can do tiles. I said, yeah, I can. So I started doing these beautiful facades with drawings, and the graffiti world is like very angry at me because I was like, you're not a graffiter, you're an artist. Why are you doing So it's a kind of graffiti, painting, drawing thing.
Yeah, yeah. And in the public and very sustainable too, no?
Yeah, yeah. And they can stand. It's very good.
And now you're on the way to Gotthof in Schleswig, installing a big show. Maybe you can tell us what you're going to show there. Is it a retrospective? Is it a new work?
No, it's interesting because Gotthof Castle is around this ancient chapel, Viking chapel. And it's a place where there was a huge Viking settlement. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing Valkyries for more than 20 years. And I do this, you know, suspended big pieces. And I call them Valkyries. And they're very textile. And they always, every piece is done for a specific place. And I named them after an important woman of that place, mm-hmm. like kind of a lost historical personality, and that people don't remember of. So I give them names from important women. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in a way, through the years, I have more than 25 Valkyries. And I've never done a show that was inspired on the theme of Valkyries. Mm-hmm. So this is a show that's called The Chateau of Valkyries. And we have... We have three Valkyries in the show, which is very rare. Normally, I only have one. And we have one on the chapel, the Viking chapel, pretty cool. And then I have other two. And they're all together. They make a kind of a dialogue of this body of work that it's very important. So the catalog is only about Valkyries. Mm-hmm. And I have other works present that give you a view of my work. But it's really interesting to come back to the place where the mythology of Valkyries is very strong. So in a way, I've been all over the world with Valkyries, but I've never exhibited the place where actually the mythology is very alive.
Interesting. And where is the shape coming from? It's like an abstract shape.
Yeah, they're organic shapes, and inspired on the Valkyries, they're flying goddesses. Mm-hmm. So it's a very organic, they are very organic figures. Many people say, oh, it's like a dragon. No, it's like a plant. No, it's like an animal. But the truth is, they're completely abstract.
Yeah.
But they have this organic look.
So you make an image of a non-image somehow.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I create these organic bodies that look like a plant or an animal, but neither of which it's really. So what I, and I call them Valkyries because they are suspended, they have this very strength presence, and they generate a dialogue with the space.
And where did the first one evolve from, like when you created the first one?
So the first one, I told you, the first little one started going to Brazil.
Of course, the small one just grew.
And then they went on growing
huge.
And growing
okay,
and growing.
Okay, okay, they grow and grow and grow. Oh,
the first one went on the suitcase to Brazil.
Yeah.
And now they are 50 meters wide and 40 meters wide.
Some even longer, right?
Some longer.
And the Tree of Life is in what context to be seen?
Okay, the Tree of Life is a completely different project because the Tree of Life was made throughout the COVID period. Mm-hmm. We had to close the studio for a year. Well, we went like without nobody seeing us really, but undercover we went to the studio. But the truth is I had to send my teams home and I had a project for Villa Borghese that never happened. And I wanted to do Daphne's tree. So the Bernini sculpture of Daphne, she's transforming, her fingers are transforming into leaves.
Yeah.
And I always wonder, what kind of tree would Daphne become? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So she's transforming, but she's on the process. So I thought that if I would exhibit with the Bernini sculpture, I would make the tree that Daphne it was transformed into.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I started that project, then the show never happened. And then some leaves that I started embroidering that would be Daphne's tree, were just stuck in the studio. So when confinement came along, and Jean-François Chenier, my curator for the show in the chapel, said, oh, we should do a Valkyrie. Everybody wanted me to do a Valkyrie.
Yeah.
I said, okay, I'll do a Valkyrie for La Sainte Chapelle in Vincennes. And then he said, what are you guys doing? Oh, we're just embroidering leaves because I sent my teams home to embroider leaves.
Yeah.
And then said, what is this for? I said, oh, it's a Daphne's tree. Oh,
so you had no plan for it. You just did it.
I was just embroidering leaves because everybody was at home with nothing to do.
Yeah.
I said, I might as well use this time and people could be at home doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So I had all my team embroidering leaves.
In different locations.
Huh? Yeah, everybody at their homes, every embroidering, they would take the bags and return to the studio and put it all in the same, take another. So we embroider 140,000 leaves.
Crazy.
Because we had time, So the project that was 5 meters for Villa Borghese became for the Sainte Chapelle in Vincennes with 15 meters.
Yeah.
And so we had time, and so we did it. So people would take wool, knit, they would embroider, they would do small things. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, we put it all together.
And where did you get your inspiration? Like, because there you were invited and reacted to the sculpture, I understand, right? Yeah. But also this just comes to you and then you also just create without sort of a clear plan where things go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can say that I'm very blessed because I channel my work. So in a way, when I see my work, I have to do it exactly as I see it. So I don't plan for it. I don't do anything for it. I just know that I have to do a wedding cake in tiles. And I know.
And then it's going to happen at some point.
It's going to happen at some point. So when I see something like the bathtub, and you were talking to me about, the surrealistic bathroom.
Yeah.
And I saw the bathtub and I said, let's make the bathtub.
Yeah. Then the bathtub is a regular bathtub, freestanding bathtub with the hole where the water runs out. But then it's not one, but 70.
A lot.
So, and it's interesting because you see it immediately in your mind. You think, how could...
The water...
You can't fill enough water into which would ever fill up the bathtub.
Yeah. That's the idea. That's impossible task to achieve.
Yeah.
You cannot fill that bathtub. And although it's called flood...
Yeah.
And it's the idea that you spend so much water unnecessarily. So we don't need bathtubs anymore. We don't need them.
No.
Although it's a symbol of luxury.
Yeah.
It's like if you have a great bathroom, you have to have a huge bathtub. Although no, what is not enough for everybody?
Yeah, yeah.
So why should you have a bathtub? So it's the impossibility of the project that I'm driven into, which is to call people's attention and say, why do we spend so much water?
But on an aesthetic sort of beautiful right. way.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Beauty is very important to
yeah,
me.
Yeah. Great, Joanna. Thank you so much. Very much looking forward to the exhibition in Gotthorf and
yes.
To continue this conversation.
Yes, do come to Gotthorf. It's going to be a great experience. Very immersive, I can tell you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.